Both incidents raised questions about the White House plan to speed up training in order to begin a troop drawdown by next summer. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
And just clarifying, the Afghan shooter did not kill himself, but was rather killed during the gunfire. In other news, the first vote on Elena Kagan's Supreme Court nomination is being held today. As the Senate Judiciary Committee met, the panel's ranking Republican, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, said he would vote no. Sessions says Kagan lacks experience. Most Republicans are expected to follow suit. But Democrats have enough votes in the full Senate to confirm President Obama's nominee to succeed retiring Justice John Paul Stevens. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 71 points at 10,083. NASDAQ down 20 at 2178. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE.
On the next Fresh Air, why malaria is still with us after 500,000 years and how mosquitoes spread it. We talk with journalist Sonia Shah, author of The Fever. Also, some of our best-loved songs got their start in movies. We talk with Philip Furia, author of The Songs of Hollywood. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Today, there are something like 2.4 million Americans behind bars, and the U.S. prison population continues to grow in spite of declining crime rates. Our guest for this hour, Focus, Mark Kleiman, who's professor of public policy at the University of California, Los Angeles, he says for years we've been trying to solve our crime problem with brute force. Is there an alternative? Well, he says the answer is yes, there is. This morning we'll be talking with Mark Kleiman about some of what you will find in a recent book that he has written. The title of his book is When Brute Force Fails: How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. It's published by the Princeton University Press, just came out last year, and is due out in paper this fall. In the book, he takes a look at a revolution in controlling crime by other than brute force incarceration, and he says that this is a revolution that is largely gone unnoticed. As we talk with our guest, Mark Kleiman, questions are welcome. We do ask people, please be brief in your comments. That will help us get as many folks as possible, but questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You also may write, send your questions along to will-talk at illinois.edu. Just a little bit more about our guest. Mark Kleiman is professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis and also on drug abuse and crime control policy. In addition to the book When Brute Force Fails, he's authored two others, Marijuana, Cost of Abuse, Cost of Control, and Against Excess, Drug Policy for Results. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And Professor Kleiman, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. Just to as they say, to do the numbers here right at the beginning again, let's review. What do we know about people who are in behind bars today in the United States?
It's about 2.4 million, so that's about 1% of the adult population. That's about five times our historic rate. You look from 1900 to 1975, the rate is constant at about 120, 130. So this is unprecedented for us. It's also unmatched in the world. We have, again, about five times the incarceration rate of any Western European country. The United States has more prisoners right now than any other country in the world. Not more per capita, more prisoners. We have more prisoners than China.
The total number we're talking about.
The total number. So with something like four times our population, China actually has fewer prisoners. If you look at the African-American population, things are much worse. the African-American incarceration rate is 4,000 per 100,000. So 4% of all African-Americans are behind bars right now. Not adults, all African-Americans. That's actually a higher incarceration rate than the Soviet Union had the day Stalin died.
Now,
and if you look particularly at the worst off among African-Americans, if you look at males who drop out of high school, they've got a better than even chance of doing prison time before they're 30. Mm-hmm. So this is a crisis. It's really a catastrophic situation.
In terms of crime rates, now it's true that the crime rates are, it's worse than it was, say, 50 years ago. But actually, if you look at what's happened over the last few years, crime rates have been declining. And as I mentioned, so in spite of that, though, we continue to put people in jail. What can we say just about where we are in terms of crime right at the moment?
Crime fell about 50% between 1994 and 2004 and has continued to drift down since, though I think at a slower rate. That did not stop the rate, the rise of incarceration. The fiscal crisis of the states did. So last year was the first year since 1975, I think, when state prison populations did not go up. The federal population went up enough to keep the national rate growing. But I think 2.4 million is going to turn out to be the high water mark. Mm-hmm. Still, that's not an acceptable place to be. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't aim to get back to 1975 incarceration rates and 1960 crime rates. And those would be two big accomplishments. And I think within our grasp, I think we now know enough about how to control people's behavior without paying their room and board bill, so that we could have much less crime and much less incarceration.
Now, I know that you have said that there was a time when you and other people argued that we needed prison space. The crime was up, so we needed to place to put people in. And you were among those people who said, yeah, we need more prisons. So the problem is, though, that while we've been seeing some decline in crime, we just kept building prisons, even after the
right.
crime rate started going down.
Right. I feel, and I'm not alone, I feel a little bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Mm. Does this thing have an off switch? Going from 500,000 prisoners to 1 million prisoners was probably not a terrible idea. But that surely was the limit. Even back then, with crime much higher than it is now. So I think we're well past the point of diminishing returns.
And I think also you made the point that given the fact that at the rates in which we incarcerate people, you would expect crime to actually have gone down way more than it did because we're locking so many people up.
Right. So that would have been true if you take the economist rational actor view of crime. So if you think of criminals as people who are just like anybody else but with different incentives and who just find it profitable to steal rather than working. But if that were your model, then pushing up the severity of punishment ought to push down the crime rate. That's the Gary Becker theory, and it's wrong. And it just turns out that people keep committing crimes even when it's massively disadvantageous. In fact, it was massively disadvantageous back in 1975. The typical burglar in 1975 was earning, if you will, about $40 for every day he spent behind bars. Not really a very attractive deal. Now it's much worse. He's earning about $6 for every day he spends behind bars. A really terrible deal. Crack dealers are getting less than the minimum wage, and they keep doing it. So clearly, just ratcheting up severity isn't the answer. And the reason is because everybody pays more attention to the immediate future than to the distant future, and to what's certain than to what's unlikely. And offenders are probably more like that than the rest of us. And so we have a punishment system that doesn't inflicts a lot of suffering, but doesn't do nearly as much behavioral control as you'd expect for the size of the enterprise.
Mm. Well, I guess I find myself going back to the question of why brute force fails, and it seems that that has always been appealing. At least, you know, if you're running for office, if you're trying to show that you're a law and order justice kind of guy, what you're going to do is say, yes, we need to have tougher sentences. We need to take the discretion away from judges so that people have tough sentences, and we make sure that when they go to jail, that they serve the time, and that we make prisons as unpleasant as we possibly can, and that that kind of rhetoric has been really successful, but it doesn't seem to work. So the question is, well, why is it that it doesn't work?
Part of the problem is, again, that, Bacharya pointed this out 250 years ago. Of the three characteristics of a punishment that determine how deterrent it is, swiftness, certainty, and severity, severity is the least important, and we've over-relied on it. The other thing is that what's unpleasant to a state legislator or a voter, not the same as what's unpleasant to a prisoner. Think about a contemporary U.S., medium to maximum security state prison. What are the characteristics of life inside? Noise, idleness, and violence. It's all the comforts of home to a lot of the people who are in there. You simply reproduced the social order of an underclass community inside the prison. If you really wanted to make a prison that people didn't want to go back to, you'd make it look a lot more like a Benedictine monastery.
So is the most important thing here trying to keep people from going to prison the first time, or is it once they've been there to try to make the idea of going back real unappealing?
I think there's an argument to be made to make prison conditions more rigorous, which doesn't mean less humane, and the sentence is shorter. But the key to whether people go in the first place and come back is not what happens inside the prison, it's what happens outside the prison. Probation and parole, which are two major alternatives to incarceration, are broken systems because we've used the same brute force logic on them that we use on the rest of the system. So a probation violation typically leads to either no sanction at all or a revocation and a trip to prison. That's crazy. Probation violation ought to lead to a couple of days in jail, but every time and right now. That's what Judge Stephen Ahm in Honolulu has demonstrated, that you can cut the crime rate among probationers by 50% and the days they spend behind bars by two-thirds by using swift and certain sanctioning for probation violations. So that's the trick. We can learn to control people in the community. We don't have to put them inside. And we can let out a lot of the ones who are in. So he's using the primary violation that's being detected in that program is drug use, because that's easy to detect. There's a chemical test for it. I think the next step is to use GPS position monitors. Right? If you know where somebody is all the time, you can control a lot of his crime-relevant behavior for a couple of dollars a day. So that would be my basic approach, would be to take money out of incarceration, put it into community corrections. But tell the community corrections folks, look, your job is not to catch people doing things wrong and put them back inside, nor is it merely to be a social service broker. Your job is to enforce a set of rules with swift and certain sanctions. And then you have to have the judges ready to follow through on that.
And you would say certainly that there are examples that show that this approach actually can work.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's no doubt it can work. The doubt is whether you can actually administer it, right? Because the program that Ahm runs means that he and his clerks and the probation officers and the probation managers and the police and the sheriff and the U.S. Marshal Service and the jail and the treatment system and the public defender and the prosecutor all have to work together smoothly. The public management challenge is much greater than the offender management challenge. The offenders will respond to the incentives they're given. The question is whether we can actually organize our public sector to deliver those incentives the right way.
And is that a matter of is this simply a matter of organization and mindset of those people? It's not that you have to be spending more money, that you have to hire more people, that you have to do some sort of dramatic restructuring. Is it just a matter of how people think about what they're doing and how they work together?
That's most of it. Some resources are necessary. In the case of HOPE, which is ALM's program, one of the things that you need is drug treatment. Mm-hmm. Right? You're catching people for drug use. Certainly, if they need treatment, you have to offer it to them. And when somebody's messed up three or four times, ALM will usually say, instead of sending them off to prison, you can go to a residential treatment program. But those things cost money. However, what you're saving on the prison side overwhelms what you're spending on the upfront side. Roughly a probation system that worked the way HOPE works, if we did it nationally, would multiply the probation budget by 2 or 2.5, which is not a trivial amount of money, but the savings on the prison side would completely swamp it. So what I'm hoping, and Congressman Schiff and Poe actually have a bill to do this, is for federal grants to jumpstart doing community corrections right. Say, look, you know, here's $1 million for your jurisdiction to get this thing started. But once it's started, it has to pay for itself out of the prison savings. So require the state legislatures to budget so that whatever prison savings are generated by these programs, half of it comes back to run the program, and the other half goes to fix the state's fiscal hole. So I think this revolution could be made over 5 years. The big mistake is starting big. You can't start this thing with 1,000 people on it. You can start it with 30 people on it and grow it, you know, once you've debugged it. And that's what ALM did. He's now got about a fifth of all the probationers on Oahu under his program, and they're probably going to take it up to 40%.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Kleiman. He's professor of public policy at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, in the School of Public Affairs. And some of what we're talking about here this morning you can read in his book, When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, published by Princeton University Press. It came out last year in hardcover, will be out this fall in paperback. Questions are certainly welcome. We have a couple of people here ready to go. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll start in here with our line 4 on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Am I on?
Yes.
Yes, I met a Japanese professor in Spain, and he said in Japan, he said they have mandatory sentences, the judge has no discretion, there is no time off for good behavior. He said they work every day from sunup to sundown, 7 days a week, and they are required to learn a trade before they can be discharged. And he said their system works very well. They have a 3% recidivism, and all the sentences are written statutes. They know exactly what they're going to get, and that's what they get. This sounds like a very effective system to me. I'd like to ask your gentleman what he thinks.
All right. Professor Kleiman, what do you think?
Well, Japan has a very different system than we have, very different crime problem than we have. The city of Tokyo has 70,000 police officers. That helps to cut down on the crime rate.
Mm.
They also have an interesting criminal procedure. Right? You want to hear the full criminal procedure in Japan? The prisoner confesses.
I'm sorry?
The whole criminal justice process consists of the criminal confesses.
No one mounts a defense?
Well, he may or may not be pissing blood at the time he confesses, but he confesses. It's not, I think, a system we want to import. Now, the Japanese prison system we desperately want to import. They have managed to make orderly and laborious prisons in which people don't get stabbed and to which they don't want to return.
Mm.
And we certainly ought to try to imitate that. But, you know, we're not a Confucian society. Not everything that works in Japan will work here.
Well, apparently it's very effective.
It's very effective in Japan.
3% recidivism is, you know, wonderful.
Yeah, I don't believe the 3% number, but...
Well, that's what he said, and he also said this learning a trade so that they can get a job when they get out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very good idea.
Yeah, it's a very good idea if you can bring it off.
Yeah.
We've basically eliminated most of those programs in our prisons.
We've eliminated?
One of the consequences of having a much too big a prison population, you can't actually deliver any services. But our experience with job training in prison was not a particularly successful one, because most of the prisons were training people for jobs that don't exist anymore. The one big success story was the Arizona system, where one of the big hotel chains outsourced its reservation function. So if you made a reservation in, I don't know, the Marriott or wherever it was, you were actually talking to a prisoner in the Arizona State Prison. Then they ran into some identity theft problems and decided that wasn't such a good idea. But that was an example of training people for jobs that actually exist rather than training them to fix cars that that aren't on the road anymore. Problems to keep the prisons up to date with jobs is not that easy. Anyway, I think most of that work needs to go on the outside, not on the inside. So we need more programs available.
Now, the problem is it's not being done, and it's never been done.
That's what I'm hoping to change.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Well, I think that what this does, though, is it points to the criticism I think people have been making for some time now, is that as far as adult criminals are concerned, we've really given up on the idea that we can reform them. What we're doing, we put them in prison, we keep them off the street for a while so they don't commit crime, but that's really all we're doing. Then we're taking them out of circulation for some period of time, but we're not doing anything for them that would try to help them be a productive, law-abiding citizen when they get out.
Correct. Now, it's not clear to me how much you can do inside that leads to behavior change that carries over to the outside. Education is clearly an example, right? If you teach somebody to read, he knows how to read when he gets out. And we got to do more of that. Again, part of the problem is we've got very, very crowded prisons and very, very stretched prison budgets. And the first thing that went was the programming.
Mm-hmm. And you also certainly do say that we should not ignore all of those things that we could try to do for people outside of the criminal justice system. So you'd be talking about remedial education, job training, drug treatment, and you know, any and all things like that.
Well, sort of, right? So yeah. Job training, the history of job training programs for probation, for that matter, the history of job training programs in general is lamentable. Turns out the best training for a job is a job, and the effective programs are the ones that tell people. The Montgomery County Pretrial Release Center in suburban Maryland, run by a guy named Stefan Labuglio. It's a halfway house. And the rules of the halfway house are that the more you do to get yourself a job, the more privileges you have inside. And it's remarkable how many of these people just coming out of prison sat down in a room with a telephone and a telephone book and the instruction that you're on a 9 p.m. curfew until you're well along to finding yourself a job. Remarkable how many of these guys can actually get a job. That seems to be the direction to go in.
Let's talk with someone else here. Let's go to line number one, the next caller. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know what? You got some good ideas, but I'll tell you one that doesn't work. It's the GPS one. I know this for a fact because I've worked with criminals before, and part of the problem is they commit crimes while they've got the GPS unit on, and that happens quite often, actually. And the other thing is, too, what do you do for the drug, the habitual drug, you know, like the you know, the sellers and whatever? I personally think the way we're going about it is the wrong way. And one thing is, a lady brought up the fact with job training. I think it needs to be outside of the prison, for one. I think that the prison's kind of like the schools anymore, where we're relying too much on too many things for one entity, and it doesn't work. It's a, you know, like you said. But here's my big deal. We're sending people to prisons on pitiless crimes. I think a lot of the people that are in there now might be thrown to prison or thrown in jail for things that are equal to or lesser than some of the other laws. It's what we are charging them with. And until we write those laws to where we're not throwing, like, for instance, if you get caught smoking pot or doing some kind of drug or even DUIs or something, it's equal to, if not more than, some of the major crimes that are out there. The other thing is the drug situation is just totally way out of hand. And, I mean, Lindsay Lohan is a good example. You know, Morton Downey Jr., a lot of people have problems, and it's no different than alcohol addiction. You got to find a system that doesn't allow them to keep repeating offenses. And there's nothing out there that I see that really helps an individual, especially if you lose a job.
Well, let's get some. Let's get some thought, because the caller, you know, raised a number of points. Maybe Professor Kleiman, you can respond to them.
Okay, so a number of things. There's a myth out there that the prisons are full of people who were just using drugs and got caught using drugs. That's not true. People who go to prison on drug charges are overwhelmingly dealers. Not a very useful activity because dealers are easily replaced. There are a number of users behind bars. But when you look at their criminal histories, you can see why they just wanted to send them away. They actually have nastier criminal histories on average than people behind bars for violent crime. So there's not a lot of gain there. South Dakota has this program called Sober 24/7, which is basically an alcohol version of HOPE using breathalyzer tests. So somebody's been convicted of a second DUI in South Dakota, facing prison time, and they're given as an option to come in twice a day for a breathalyzer test. So the point is not to keep them from drinking and driving. The point is to keep them from drinking. Seems to work spectacularly well. So I think there's a lot of prospect there. As to GPS, sure, some people are going to commit crimes. And it won't be very hard to convict them if you've got a record showing that they were where the crime was committed. My colleague, Angela Hawken from Pepperdine, has a phrase I love. She says, what you want to do is behavioral triage. Instead of using risk assessment tools to decide who's dangerous or not, see who's dangerous by their behavior. Put them out in the community, watch them like a hawk. They'll tell you whether they need a prison cell or not. And if they know that's the deal, most of them won't.
And your point is obviously too is if you're watching them closely, you if they do commit a crime, then again, as you say, that immediately they have to go to jail. There can be no delays. That gets back to the swiftness and the certainty. Maybe
right.
We should emphasize that as much, if not more, than the severity.
Right. Not even committing a new crime. Right. If you say to the guy, look, you stole a car. We're not going to put you in prison. You're on 2 years probation. The first 90 days, you're on a 9 p.m. curfew. If he's on the street at 10 p.m., he's got to be in jail the next day. Not for long. 2 days is plenty. But he's got to be reminded that the rule is real. And if you can do that, then they won't violate the rule very much. So this is the magic of concentrated enforcement. You can actually get better behavioral control with less punishment if you're consistent about it.
That's one of the interesting things you say the perfect threat is the one that you never have to carry out, and that the warnings here in a lot of these cases, the warnings are the things that do the work. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would hear that and say, no, that can't possibly work, but there are places where it has been demonstrated that, in fact, it does work.
Right. And to all of those people, I would say, have you ever raised a child? Have you ever trained a puppy? Have you ever managed a sports team? Right. These are not new principles. Every mother, every animal trainer, every coach, every manager knows these principles. I mean, all the successful ones. Consistent rules. Enforced every time.
Hmm. What about those people who would look at a case, say this example that someone steals a car, and you say, all right, rather than at that point putting them in jail, saying, okay, look, here's the deal. We're going to give you an opportunity to get yourself together and not become a career car thief. And we're going to have these rules, and there's going to be a curfew, and you're going to have electronic monitoring and, you know, whatever else goes with it. And then we'll say, we're going to give you this chance. Now, if you don't, you can go one of two ways. It's up to you. I suppose there are some people who would say that somehow they have a problem with the notion that there's still lack of punishment there. I guess they somehow think that there ought to be some sort of greater negative sanction other than these kinds of things that we're talking about.
Well, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with a split sentence. You can send somebody to 6 months in jail and then 2 years probation. I think for a lot of the people that we're trying to control, having to be at home at 9 o'clock every night for the next 3 months or 6 months, it's a much stiffer sanction than 30 days in jail.
Hmm.
Not only that, the fact that they've got to go home from the party early because they're on probation is a living reminder to all their friends not to get in trouble. Part of the problem is we're doing this enormous amount of punishment where nobody sees it. And so the guy thinking about stealing a car right now, you know, doesn't see the guy that he used to hang with who's now in jail for stealing a car.
And this, we should also make the point that I'm sure you would say that there are people that definitely need to be in jail, and maybe need to be jailed for a long time, and maybe need to be in jail, and you know who knows whether they ever come out. But you're reserving that for the absolute most recalcitrant, hardcore people who are demonstrated that they're not interested in changing.
Yeah, there are three groups of people who need to be in prison. There are people we need to make an example of, like Bernie Madoff. There are people whose string of crimes is such that it's just worth our while to spend the $30,000 a year not to have them around. Now, that's true of very few people over the age of 50. Even few people over the age of 35. People age out of crime, particularly violent crime, pretty quickly. And then the third group of people who need to be in prison are the people who will not behave themselves in the community when they're given a chance to. My guess is if we had an effective enforcement system for community corrections, that third group would be pretty small. Hope it's about 10%. You know, just will not do it and wind up either absconding or going off to prison. But the rest eventually straighten up and fly right.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Mark Kleiman. He's professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He teaches courses on methods of policy analysis and also drug abuse and crime control policy. He's the author of the books Marijuana, Cost of Abuse, Cost of Control, Against Excess, Drug Policy for Results, and his most recent. The title is When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. Now, if you'd like to read a more thorough treatment of the ideas we're talking about here this morning, you look for the book published last year in hardcover by Princeton University Press. Will be coming out in paperback this fall. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next caller is line number two. Hello.
Hello. What I'm going to say is anecdotal, but shall we say set in concrete. I did 8 years in the North Carolina prison system for selling 2 hits of acid. And when I was inside, I came across the third groups that you have talked about. One thing in regards to learning a trade inside, and this became a very unfortunate thing that happened at the Walls, they were training guys to become barbers. And the first class that was released, several of these guys were armed robbers. And a lot of them had seen a lot of hard times, and they gave up, in a sense, a lot of prestige within the prison system itself to take this course, because a lot of guys looked upon it as pansy. Well, what it got is North Carolina had a state law saying that anybody that was an ex-felon not do, and there were a list of number of things they couldn't do. One of them was being a barber.
Right.
And somehow at the top, when you have men that are educated, the superintendent was PhD in criminology, didn't take the time to find out about actual reality. They had about 75 guys who weren't the sort of guys you were supposed to do this sort of thing to. And, of course, the whole program fell to pieces, and that gave the warden at the wall one hell of a time for the next 3 or 4 years. Nobody believed anybody of authority what they were saying because of that reaction. When I was going through, I got a lot of psychologists like to play around with me and gave me tests and asked me questions and things because I was educated. And a number of them, about four of them out of maybe 9 or 10, stated that from their studies, and I don't know what studies they were talking about, that 2 and 2.5 years, it was about optimum to get somebody some punishment and getting back out on the street where he's going to not go back. I was also told that the recidivism rate at the time I was in, which was at 71 through 79, was about like 82% in North Carolina. And I did see some guys that got released or on parole and came right back before I even left the walls. And the community thing you're talking about seems to me a very realistic thing. Because I think about what I would have done and how it would have affected me at that point. So I think it's a very sensible program, and I like the way you go about it, talking in terms of manifestations of certain, in a sense, matrices of lines of communication and stuff. Being in at 9 o'clock at night is a killer to any guy that's had lots and lots of freedom where he's doing crime and stuff like that. If he can handle that, I think he's a pretty good candidate to, you know, give him a chance. And if he screws up, put him away for a while. 2, 2.5 years inside will do a lot of things for a person. Thanks.
All right. Well, you react to that any way you like?
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that the caller was the victim of a stupidly excessive sentence. And... yeah, 2 or 2.5 years seems to me like for lots of crimes, plenty. You know, enough to not to say this is serious. And people worth keeping longer, again, if they would be committing so many crimes on the outside that we just can't stand to have them around.
Other questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Mark Kleiman. He's professor of public policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. What?
The other point
I
want to follow up on.
Sure.
Is the importance of having a system that's predictable and sensible from the point of view of the people inside it, mm-hmm. right? So when it turned out that this barber training program was training people for a job that they couldn't hold, right? The credibility of the warden was shot, and that's something we don't pay nearly enough attention to. From the point of view of offenders, our criminal justice system is pretty random, and that's a very bad thing. The psychologists tell us that the single best predictor of whether somebody succeeds in attempting to change his own behavior, you know, lose weight or give up smoking or any of that stuff, is a measure they call locus of control. So everything that happens to us is the result of some combination of our own actions and things that happen to us, either random chance or the behavior of other people. But you can ask people about things that happen to them and ask them to attribute causality. And the people who tend to attribute causality outside themselves, the people with an external locus of control, have a very hard time changing their behavior. While people who tend to attribute outcomes or their own actions have a much easier time changing behavior. Now, look, neither of those points of view is realistic, talking about the attitude that people take. Well, one way to give people an internal locus of control is to create a predictable environment where the outcomes are tightly coupled to their actions. And that's something our current system doesn't do. The outcomes are pretty random. You know, somebody commits 50 burglaries and gets caught for one of them and goes off to prison. Well, what he learns from that is he had bad luck. You know, he violates probation 12 times and then gets sent to prison. Well, what he learns is the probation officer was mad at me that day. So that's part of the reason to have consistency, is to create a predictable environment for people who very often didn't grow up in a predictable environment.
Now, just for a second, one other thing. We talked earlier, you talked earlier about the fact that there, classically, people say that there are three parts to effective punishment: severity, swiftness, certainty. And that our problem here is that we have emphasized severity at the expense of the other two. What do you think about various kinds of legislations like three strikes and you're out, or maybe various kinds of mandatory sentencing? I assume that you would say that is a problem. Why is that a problem?
Well, three strikes is a waste of prison space. Right? I mean, the thing to remember is we do not have an infinite number of beds. Mm. Everybody inside is crowding out somebody else. What three strikes does, as Phil Hyman likes to say, is convert prisons into retirement homes for former burglars. There are a lot of 55-year-olds in California prisons. First off, they're expensive prisoners because they've got health problems. And second, they, you know, their crime rate on the outside would be most very low. What you care about is not how many crimes somebody's committed over a lifetime. You could care about the rate of crimes. Somebody with a second felony conviction at 19 is a much more dangerous character than somebody with a third felony conviction at 40. But the three strikes law pays no attention to rate. It's all count, which is just wrong. It's not the case that laws like three strikes eliminate discretion. The discretion is just still there. It's now moved from the judge to the prosecutor. The prosecutor doesn't have to charge the strikes. And not obvious to me that that's a particularly useful way to move discretion. But the notion you're getting rid of discretion is just wrong. Can't get rid of discretion. Somebody's always got it.
Let's take another call. We have several. We have about 7-8 minutes left. Next, I believe that we will talk with somebody on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. I don't know that if citizens really understand that 33 people in prison for a year at $33,000 a year equals just about $1 million a year. But I'd like you to appraise my statement that reason our state is going broke, one reason is because recently a person was sentenced for receiving marijuana through the mail to 15 years and a $60,000 fine. By the time he gets out, it's going to cost the state over $500,000. And plus, when he gets out, a convicted felon is going to have a much harder time getting a job. His only recourse could be crime. And that doesn't include the cost of his family possibly going on welfare, because so often the male is the chief breadwinner. What is your appraisal of that?
I'd like to know the circumstances of a case which somebody got 15 years for receiving marijuana in the mail. I got to imagine he was receiving a very large amount of marijuana, or that he had a very long criminal history. If not, we've got a prosecutor and a judge completely out of control. Again, putting drug dealers in prison is a very unuseful activity. Unlike burglars, they get replaced because there's a market. I think that's one of the best places to save on incarceration costs. But I think the caller's basic point was a crucial one, which is that the people who are out there demonstrating against wasteful government spending never seem to list incarceration. But the 5-year mandatory minimum for 5 grams of crack means at federal costs about $250,000
for a $250 transaction. Now, that's wasteful government spending, if you like. We ought to start budgeting. We currently budget prisons simply by looking at the number of sentences and allocating the appropriate amount of money. We ought to do it the other way. We ought to budget every county for a certain number of prison years that can be imposed in that county this year. And let the prosecutors work out who it is they really want to send it away. Too many prosecutors think that they're doing their job best when they get the longest sentence. That's not right.
Well, do you think that public opinion might change if there was more reporting on what the costs of putting a person in jail are?
Maybe, though in fact and in truth, I mean, prisons are a big problem for state budgets because they're one of the few discretionary items in a state budget. You know, with Medicaid and education usually taking most of the money. In fact, on a national basis, incarceration costs about $60 billion a year. Policing costs twice that. The total criminal justice budget is about $200 billion a year. It's not a huge amount of money. If we were getting good crime control for that money, I'd say fine. In fact, when I think about changing prisons, saving money is the least of my interests. I'd rather spend more money and have people come back less. So I'm happy that the state fiscal crisis is putting a brake on reckless prison building. This is not really mostly a money issue. I mean, if it's worth inflicting that amount of suffering on the prisoner and his family and his friends, it's worth the $30,000.
Let's talk with someone else. Line four. Hello.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes.
Okay. A woman called earlier, and she was wanting much harsher conditions for prisoners in our prisons. And there are several responses that could be made to her comment. But I think the most important point to make is that there are a number of people in our prisons who are innocent. Now, of course, I am aware that the great majority of people in prison are guilty, but certainly we know that there is a fairly significant number of people who are not guilty or innocent. Now, I think that fact alone is perhaps the most important reason why the conditions in prison should not be especially harsh. And what is your comment on that?
It's a good point, underappreciated point. My horseback guess is that if the 2.4 million people behind bars right now, something like 100,000 didn't do it. I mean, not that there was some technical problem with the trial. They actually weren't the person who did that crime.
Yes.
And we ought to work harder. If I were a governor and didn't have to run for re-election, I would try to set up a separate bureau whose job consisted entirely of reinvestigating the cases of people in prison to find the innocent ones, with full subpoena and you know, all the powers of police and prosecutors to try to undo the injustice. But it's worth noting that harsh and cruel aren't the same thing, right? Our current prison system is incredibly cruel. Right? We tolerate a lot of prisoner-on-prisoner violence, including sexual violence. Effectively tighter prison regime would undo that. So I don't think the monastery prison is a particularly cruel place. But it may be a place that people really don't want to go back to, and that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to create an environment that's aversive so that people don't want to go to it and don't want to return to it without being damaging. And that's a tough needle to thread, but I don't think our current system is anywhere near the optimum.
Yes, I agree.
All right, I thank you for the call, and we'll do one more here. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
To what extent is the incarceration industry lobbying to get legislative outcomes in their favor?
In places where there's a lot of private prisons, there's no doubt that the places like the Correction Corporation of America are working hard to keep the population up. In places where there aren't private prisons, then it tends to be either the prison guards unions or the small and economically disadvantaged towns where the prisons are located. They put the pressure on. So in New York State, the Senate Republican majority leader was from an area whose primary industry was incarceration. And he strongly resisted changing the Rockefeller drug laws, specifically because he didn't want to lose jobs for his town. That's a problem. I don't think it's the major problem. I think the reason we have a lot of prisons is because the public was terrified about crime and demanded something be done. Now that crime is down, I think we have a chance to change things.
Well, we have about maybe 2 minutes here, though. We've talked about some examples, and you have examples in your book where we have systems that look at alternatives to incarceration that not only work better in terms of reducing people in jail and once they've been there, cutting down the chance they're going to go back. So not only do they work better, they're more cost effective, but I still wonder, what are the roadblocks? What are the things that prevent communities from actually doing those things or at least trying those things?
I think the major roadblocks are, first, fear and rage. Law and order is still a somewhat winning political issue. Second, lack of knowledge of what's possible. And that's partly generated by the fact that there's no particular partisan advantage to the kind of program that I'm talking about. And so, there are a few legislators who are interested in this. So far, there are very few reporters who are interested in this. This does not make headlines. Sheriff Joe Arpaio's latest sadistic stunt in Maricopa County, will get national headlines. But hope doesn't, because it's undramatic. And people expect dramatic solutions to serious problems, which makes the undramatic harder. And the final barrier is public management. As I say, these are not easy programs to actually do. And, of course, a national mood of denigrating public officials and regarding them as all lazy, overpaid parasites doesn't really help in trying to reform systems. Mm. So if we had a little more faith in government, my friend Steve Tellis has pointed out that there's a paradox. That the biggest expansion of state power in American history, putting 1% of the entire adult population behind bars, was occasioned by distrust in government. It's weird that people who distrust government want to expand the power of the state, but that's what happened.
Well, there, I think we're going to have to leave it. If you want to read more, I certainly would recommend the book that I've talked about here, mentioned a couple of times, When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, published by Princeton University Press, just came out last year and will be out this fall in paper by our guest Mark Kleiman. He is professor of public policy at the University of California in Los Angeles. Professor Kleiman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, there'll be news and some sports and weather and a lot of other things throughout the next hour. And sitting in as host today, Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, David, and good afternoon, everybody. We'll begin the Afternoon Magazine segment with a look at the commodity prices, then NPR News, followed by AM 580 headlines, and coming up after that, Europe Today from the BBC. First of all, let's take a look at how commodity prices are doing. The September wheat contract in Kansas City is down 5.5 cents at 589.75. September wheat in Chicago is at 575 a bushel. That's off 7.25 cents. December in Chicago, 604.75, down 6.75. Now, the corn prices may be leading the commodity market downward today on more news of good weather and firm outside markets. The September corn is down 6.25 cents at 375.25. December at 388.75, off 5.25 cents. March at 401.25, down 4.75. Crude oil is up 54 cents a barrel right now at 77.08. In the bean complex, August soybeans are at 10.04¾, down 3¼ cents. The September contract down 3¾ at 9.82½. And the November contract in beans at 9.67¾, down 4¼. January 9.76, down 4. August soybean meal at $300.80, down 4.20. And bean oil for August up 23 at 38.19. Livestock, August live cattle at 93.05, down 7.5. August feeder cattle, 114.40, down 2.5. August lean.